You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When it comes to solving the nation's problems, health care, immigration, financial reform, the debates on Capitol Hill are always heated, but Eric Pooley says that when it comes to addressing climate change, it's downright hot. Some cities and states have tried to adjust, but most would acknowledge that for real change to occur, it has to be done on the federal level. Mr. Pooley, the deputy editor of Bloomberg Businessweek and former chief White House correspondent for Time magazine, has written a book called The Climate War, which chronicles the ongoing political skirmishes and profiles the players as they negotiate the future of the planet. His book is published by Hyperion, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it brings Eric Pooley to our show today. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
How is your book different from all the other recent books about climate change? Is this, in your case, you have a journalistic background. Should I assume that this is more about politics and business than it's about the scientific aspect?
Well, this is a narrative of the players who are trying to craft a compromise that can get through our, frankly, dysfunctional political system. So it is a book about political and economic debate. There's some climate science in it because it's unfolding across years against the backdrop of an evolving understanding of what's happening in our climate system.
But hasn't the public become less interested? The polls indicate that public opinion on the urgency to address climate change has slipped since its high after An Inconvenient Truth was released.
There was no doubt a slipping. There's a waxing and waning over time. And we hit last fall what seemed to be a low, and it might be coming back now. There was a poll last week taken by Yale University and George Mason University that found that 77% of those asked were in favor of mandatory reduction of carbon emissions, which is what we have to do if we want to get serious about this. So the question is whether the oil spill can begin to change the pattern, whether the anger over what's happened can flood back from oil spill to climate bill.
Well, they are slightly tangential.
I don't think they're tangential.
I think the climate is affected by our use of fossil fuels.
They're intimately related, and here's why. If we're going to get off of oil and reduce the chances of having this sort of catastrophic event take place, obviously that's a long-term transition that goes to the heart of our industrial economy. And we can only accelerate it if we put a price on carbon, we start capping and reducing our carbon emissions, and that accelerates the transition to clean energy. So the oil spill is just another sign of why we need to do this.
Well, the president has a lot on his plate right now, and yet you say this may be the last week then he can pull something off?
Well, this is a big week in the climate debate, Leonard, and here's why. After the oil spill and the when Obama was sort of personally engulfed by the slick, if you will, he began to change the subject by talking about the need to get to clean energy and talking about championing a mandatory cap on carbon to do it. He had been not talking much about this for a long, long time, and his political advisors had been urging him not to make a big deal of this. They chose to do health care instead last year, as you well know.
And they were talking about the possibility of more drilling.
Yes, indeed, they were. But that's part – Obama saw that as part of a grand bargain that would allow him to put through a climate bill. So it would be expanded offshore drilling, subsidies for nuclear power and advanced coal technology in exchange for – a cap on carbon. He was trying to change the subject from the oil spill. So he began to talk about this again. And the question is whether he means it or not. If he really means it, this is the week for him to take it up in a big way. And tomorrow night when he gives his speech is the time when he needs to put the case in front of the public, because the Senate this week is deciding what will be in the bill that it will try to move over the summer.
How effective was all of that news about the so-called ClimateGate scandal?
Well, ClimateGate, and I looked into it very closely, gave anybody who wanted to stop thinking about this a great reason to stop thinking about it. You could go to the sites that are full of misinformation about what were actually in those emails and satisfy yourself that the science was entirely cooked and we didn't have to worry about it anymore. The truth is none of that is accurate. And although there were some emails that the scientists in question were not proud of, they did not in any case point to scientists who were falsifying evidence, and they did nothing to undermine our understanding of what's happening to the climate, which is it's getting warmer and man is the reason why. Don't take my word for it. Just last month, the National Academy of Sciences put out the most definitive report ever, and it said, quote, climate change is occurring, is caused largely by human activities, and poses significant risks for a broad range of human and natural systems. No ifs or buts there.
And yet we have people who continue to deny it. We have a couple of people in Congress who will still say that there's really no problem. James Imhoff of Oklahoma, Senator Lisa Murkowski, the Republican from Alaska, launched her a measure to undo the U.S. EPA's findings that carbon emissions endanger human health.
Well, this is really at the heart of my book. Why is it so hard for us to take this issue seriously? Why is it so difficult for our political system to move on it? I'm trying to bridge the gulf between what the science says is necessary and what our politics says is possible. So I'm looking at all of the players who have made it so far impossible for us to take action.
My guest is Eric Pooley, whose book, The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth, is published by Hyperion. By the way, we will be broadcasting President Obama's speech tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on both WNYC AM and FM, which brings me to the whole matter of the role that journalists have played in publicizing the arguments of the deniers.
The media has not bathed itself in glory when it comes to climate change. It has engaged in what we call balance as bias. It presents two sides of this debate, even when there are not two valid sides. Now, I will hasten to add, it doesn't mean that everything is understood, that the debate within the scientific community is entirely settled. There are vast areas of uncertainty about exactly what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, where it's going to happen. But the basics, fundamental science of climate change has been well understood for 100 years. And the people who present themselves as experts on the other side are sometimes scientists, but more often they're representatives of conservative anti-tax and anti-regulation organizations out of Washington who try to spread doubt and confusion about what's happening. This goes back to the American Petroleum Institute's Global Climate Action Plan from 1998, where they said that the victory will be achieved when doubt about the reality of climate science creeps into the conventional wisdom, and they've been remarkably successful.
What role has Siegfried Friedrich Singer played in the denier community?
He is one of the leading scientists in the denier community, and I differentiate between professional deniers, and Dr. Singer is one of them.
There's also a man named Myron Ebel.
Yes, he's one of the leading professional deniers. I distinguish between them and the skeptics, average folks who are trying to figure out what to believe here. The professional deniers have done such a good job that if you go to the wrong website or tune into the wrong media, you will find very persuasive arguments that there's nothing at all to worry about. Dr. Singer is somebody who denied the role of secondhand tobacco smoke as a cause of cancer. He denied that chlorofluorocarbons were causing the ozone hole, and he stopped saying that after we eliminated them and the hole started to repair itself. So he has been a serial denier, and now he denied for many years that climate change was happening at all. And when that was no longer tenable, he decided that it was unstoppable and caused by natural forces and that there's nothing we can do about it.
Is he one of the true believers that you refer to in your subtitle, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth? Or is he somebody who is economically benefiting from being the counterweight to what most scientists claim is the case?
Well, I think he does derive some economic benefit from it, but and I can't peer into his soul and decide whether or not he's sincere. But I do know that a lot of the so-called deniers or skeptics are sincere, and they're not motivated just by money any more than the scientists on the other side are motivated by the paycheck that they happen to draw. There are people who derive their entire identities from their denial stance, and I think Singer is one of them. He's a star in what I call the denialosphere. He is lauded as one of the great scientists of all time within that strange little world that I take you into in this book.
And what gives him that star status? Has he really done any important scientific work?
No, he was an important scientist many, many years ago. He was one of Lyndon Johnson's advisors in the satellite program in the 60s. That was before he began his career of serial denial that happened to be supported by a succession of industry groups. He is a striking figure, but by no means the only figure. There are an array of scientists and a few respected climate scientists who hold these skeptical views. But the vast majority of climatologists, somewhere around 97% of them, agree that the world is warming and that human carbon emissions are the reason why.
Well, I've had a few scientists who've come on the show, said, yes, there is global warming, but it isn't really man-made. This is just a normal cycle that the Earth goes through.
Well, some people say that. That is not the majority consensus. And the fact is, I think the real message of my book, Leonard, is that we have the policy tools to deal with this. We know what to do. And the various arguments don't hold water. The argument that you mentioned that it's natural variation, we can't do anything about it. If we do nothing, and that turns out to be wrong, we've left a catastrophic mess for our children's children. And there's no reason to wait because we can get started now. It's not going to break the bank. Another denier position is that the costs of climate action will be unsupportable. That's not true if we act now. And I analyze these arguments and the people who make them in the book.
What about the other side? Is it complicated by the war within the environmentalist community between the idealists and the pragmatists?
Oh, it's certainly complicated by that. The conservatives are very good at unanimous messaging. They all say the same thing at the same time. The left has never been very good at that. And when a new bill is introduced, the left will pick it apart. Is it good enough? Does it go far enough? Is it paying off bad interests? Are the polluters benefiting too much?
Is this a bad tendency?
Well, it has a good side and a bad side, I think. You want to have people outside the system calling for more and better and tougher and quicker and now. And you want to have people working inside the system trying to get it done. When you do get into a sort of circular firing squad sort of situation against an enemy that is extremely disciplined, then it's problematic. And I'll take it as an example, the Waxman-Markey bill, which passed the House last June, a year ago, with support from many of the environmental groups, but not all of them, and support from some mainstream voices like Paul Krugman, but not others. And there were some political columnists from the mainstream who were calling it the epitome of all that was wrong with Washington. Tom Friedman wrote a column saying, I'm ashamed by this bill. It's a terrible bill.
Because it made too many concessions as far as they were concerned.
And then he said, but we have to bring it over to the Senate and pass it because it's the best we can do. But some folks just never got past that first paragraph. We lacked clear messages and champions for that bill. And that bill came out in the heat of the tea bag summer. And I went to an event in Charlottesville, Virginia, where they were singing songs about cap and trade and demonizing those who had voted for it. And it was really the first flush of the Tea Party movement that began with the attack on cap and trade and then washed over into the healthcare debate.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk. That's the House bill we've just been talking about, the Waxman-Markey bill. There's also a bill in the Senate that's different. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about what happened in Bali, in Kyoto, in Rio, in Copenhagen, and why it's so difficult to get anything done as we continue this conversation with Eric Pooley. His book, The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth, which is published by Hyperion. We're back with Eric Pooley, who's deputy editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. He has also served as managing editor of Fortune, an editor of Time Europe, and national editor and chief political correspondent and White House correspondent for Time magazine. His book, The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth, is published by Hyperion. Can you talk about some of the battles of this war over how to address climate change? For example, you begin in Bali in 2007 in the run-up to the Copenhagen conference in 2009. Why not start with the climate summit in Kyoto or even Rio de Janeiro in 1992? This is a story that goes back a long time.
Well, I do go back to those. I just didn't lead with them. The frame of the book is from Bali in December of 2007 through Copenhagen in December of 2009. But within that frame, I go back through the history. I talk about the fights over Kyoto. I talk about the Rio Earth Summit. And I even go back before the climate battle came to the fore to the acid rain cap and trade program that was championed by the policy rebels at the Environmental Defense Fund, who saw what was coming with the climate problem and wanted to create a precursor, a model for what they thought would work on carbon. And they did that with the acid rain program. The first Bush administration, George H.W. Bush, was the champion of that piece of legislation, which was enormously successful. It reduced the sulfur dioxide emissions that caused acid rain beyond expectations and at a fraction of the expected cost. And that, to the people at EDF, was proof of concept that a cap on emissions from carbon would do the trick for global warming. And they used that to go out and spread the word to help get that baked into the global deal at Kyoto. And of course, the Senate refused to act on that here in the United States.
And we often say that the problem is third world countries when it comes to getting a deal cut. But it was the United States that refused to go along with it. If the U.S. doesn't go along with Kyoto, the whole thing falls apart.
When it's absolutely true. I report in this book, and it had never been told before publicly, but at the beginning of the Obama administration, Al Gore sent a memo, a confidential memo, to President Obama laying out why it was so important for the United States to pass a climate bill before Copenhagen in December of 2009, because the world was looking to the United States for leadership and would not act on a global deal until the United States proved that it was willing to act. So the United States did not take that. And, you know, back in Bali when I was there, I thought that surely over the next 2 years we would take steps to get this done. I ended up writing a bit of a whodunit, a kind of a political thriller about who killed the climate bill. And again, it has a chance this week if the president seizes enormous initiative. But sometimes I felt like a homicide detective, a guy named Marty Davin. I was a crime reporter at New York Magazine when I got started. And Davin would go to a hospital after a shooting in Manhattan, and he'd catch up with the gunshot victim who would be laying on a gurney getting wheeled into the emergency room. And he would lean over the victim and ask him, "Who killed you?" And the victim would look up at him and say, I'm not dead. And Davin would say, "Well, you're going to die. You might as well tell me who did it." And sometimes when I was on Capitol Hill interviewing the politicians who were trying valiantly to move this legislation, I would feel like Marty Davin and say, "Who killed your bill?" And they would say, "It's not dead yet, but it hasn't passed yet either."
Well, Waxman-Markey's been around for a while. It's not going anywhere. The Senate bill is Lieberman-Warner. How long has that been around?
Well, Lieberman-Warner was the bill in 2008. Now there's the new version, which is Kerry Lieberman, because Warner retired and John Kerry has stepped in.
And a few people have jumped off the ship, haven't they?
Yes, they have indeed.
Lindsey Graham, for example.
Lindsey Graham spent months, hundreds of hours negotiating with stakeholders and Kerry and Lieberman to try to put together a bill that could pass in the Senate. Lindsey Graham, of course, the Republican from South Carolina, did it at no small political disadvantage with his base because he believed in the issue. He was inheriting the mantle of climate courage from John McCain, if you will, who has been one of the leaders. But now that McCain has a primary challenge on his right, he's decided that that this is not the issue for him, and he's gone back. Now, Graham followed him. The very dramatic, 2 days before they were set to release the Kerry Lieberman Graham bill, Graham held a press conference saying that he was out. And why was he out? Well, he was out because Majority Leader Harry Reid had decided that immigration reform was going to go first before climate and energy reform. Even though there was no immigration bill, and this was basically a transparent attempt to curry favor with Latino voters, since Reid and others are involved in tough election campaigns as well. So for the Democrats, it was in everybody's interest to pretend that they were really going to do something and string along the environmental community and then not do anything. The only guy in whose interest it was not was Lindsey Graham, because he was getting hammered by his base. So he said, if you guys aren't serious about it, I'm out. And he's been out ever since.
So the excuse was a political one. You have to ask yourself, well, don't these people look at – didn't they see an inconvenient truth? Or if they think that's too biased, don't they read any of the scientific studies? Don't they also have a responsibility as people who can affect change?
Well, they absolutely do. And the Senate has been cowardly on this issue. The Senate has let concerns that need to be addressed but don't need to derail legislation prevent them from action. It will take presidential leadership to get this done. It will take Barack Obama going to the Hill or summoning the chairman from the relevant Senate committees to the Oval Office and saying that as the leader of the Democratic Party, I demand that we move this bill now.
Well, what is it called, the Kerry Lieberman bill now?
Yes.
That also has been accused of by some environmentalists as not having enough bite, but by people in the industry as having too much. So this is the same old story. What are we doing here? We're balancing concern for the environment with the impact it's going to have on the business community?
Yes, and you have to do that because it's not just the business community. It's also the consumers. If you pass a climate bill that doubles the price of electricity, that bill is going to be repealed quickly. So it has to be economically sustainable as well as environmentally sustainable. And the good news is that we do know how to cushion carbon-intensive industries and consumers in the 25 states that get 50% or more of their electricity from coal. We know how to cushion them from the economic effects of a climate bill. We just have to have the guts to do it. And the president, as the steward of the American economy, has to go to the senators from those states and say, I'm going to guarantee that this will work, and I'm going to give you political cover to make it happen. So far, the president has not been willing to engage on that level, and he needs to start now.
My guest is Eric Pooley, who's written a book called The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth. It's published by Hyperion. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You're suggesting what you were just talking about was cap and trade?
Well, it's a modified version of the cap and trade program that was first in the McCain-Lieberman bills from early in this decade, and then evolved into the Warner-Lieberman bill and then the Waxman-Markey bill. The important part is the cap. That's the mandatory declining limit on carbon emissions. That's the grail here. The trade is just a way to smooth out costs for companies. There were concerns after the crash of 2008 that the trade would allow too much speculation. So Kerry Lieberman addresses that by not allowing anybody who isn't emitting to trade. So I can't go in as a Wall Street speculator and buy up a lot of carbon allowances and trade them. That won't be permitted. The bill is a hybrid bill that tries a lot of things to move this, and there's still opposition to it. It won't pass in its current form, but it could be the basis for a compromise. It might take the rest of this year to get it done, but I think it's well worth doing.
Well, the environmental community is split on cap and trade and all the variants. Why?
Well, there are people who believe that a carbon tax would be a simpler, purer way to get this done. I think anybody who's looked at the IRS code would question whether taxation can ever be simple. And by the time a simple carbon tax moved through both houses of Congress, it would no longer be simple or pure. We can count on that. The thing that people need to understand about the cap is that the allowances that it gives to polluting entities to try to cushion the price shock on consumers, the value of those allowances is passed on directly to the consumer, so it's not a windfall profit for the polluters. There's a lot of concern about that in the environmental community. They don't want to reward the polluter, and I agree with that. But if the law says that the value must be passed on to the consumer, then I think that's a smart way to cushion people from the rising electricity costs.
The Environmental Defense Fund played a major role in achieving a cap on sulfur dioxide that causes acid rain. Would it be accurate to say that the EDF is obsessed with caps?
Yes, they are a true believer in the cap. There are a lot of true believers in this book, and they're not all on the environmental side. The deniers and the skeptics have their own belief system. The EDF folks are true believers in the effectiveness of a cap and on market mechanisms.
A man named Fred Krupp is one
Fred of the Krupp
people.
Is the president of the EDF, and he's one of the main characters in the book. And what we do is follow him as he makes a very uneasy alliance with the CEO of a major utility, a man named Jim Rogers, who's a very mysterious, somewhat slippery character in the book who opposes some bills, even as he's giving grand speeches about the need for climate action. He's helping to kill a climate bill behind the scenes. And Krupp helps to swing him to support the Waxman-Markey bill, and that's one of the main reasons that Waxman-Markey was able to pass, because Krupp helped get Rogers on board, and Rogers helped get other members of the utility industry on board. And it was a healthy portion of those free allowances we were talking about that picked the lock. And the important thing for people to understand there is those allowances have nothing to do with the emissions levels overall. Those are set by law and reduced year after year. And whether you're paying for your allowances or getting them for free has no environmental implication.
Jim Rogers is the president, chairman, and CEO of Duke Energy, which is a company that owns a lot of coal-fired power plants. Is he being idealistic now? Has he been won over by idealism, or does he see something to be gained by the EDF's position?
Well, he sees something to be gained, and he,
is this a clean coal story?
He's a complicated figure, and as I say, a mysterious figure. He's vilified by many environmentalists because he's building a coal-fired power plant in North Carolina right now, one that can't capture or store any of its CO2 emissions. For a lot of people on the environmental left, that's end of story. If he's doing that, he can't possibly be on the right side of this story. Krupp needed a emitter, and the other folks in an organization called US Cap, which is a coalition of environmentalists and Fortune 500 corporate CEOs who are trying to pass a cap. The Krupp's point is that altruism isn't going to get this done. If we have to have it be in the self-interest of the polluters to clean up. We have to have a profit motive for going green, or we're never going to do this in time. And so he helped recruit Jim Rogers and keep him on board when Rogers was getting wobbly. There's some very dramatic scenes where Rogers is going off the reservation and Krupp is getting him back on the reservation. Krupp is willing to cut those deals because he believes that a compromise in the center is the only way to get this done, and that if the framework is put into place and it's a sound framework, we can then ratchet it down over time.
Is carbon capture and storage still not feasible?
It's feasible, and it's already being done. It's been done for quite some time. The question is whether you can scale it up as would be necessary, and the amount of infrastructure that would be required to capture and store just a percentage of say maybe a third or a half of the coal-fired emissions in this country would be about the size of the existing petroleum infrastructure. So it's a huge undertaking. We have to try, and we're going to try, not only because we need to capture those emissions and we need the electricity, at least for a while, that those plants are creating, but also because the price of admission to getting this done is getting the coal industry and the electricity industry to buy into the deal. We may not like that. We may wish that in a perfect world that wasn't the case, but this is the only political system that we have, and that's how it works.
now Lindsey Graham has joined Dick Lugar, the Republican from Indiana, on a bill that abandons the cap. Do you think that that is likely to be passed?
Well, the Senate is not going to pass that bill, but they are going to try to pass an energy bill that does not have the cap. They want to leave the cap out. They're scared of the politics. They don't want to go there before the midterm election. And it's up to Obama.
But why are the Tea Party people so opposed to the cap?
Well, they see it as a tax. It's just a tax to them. They're opposed to all taxes and all regulation. End of story. If on top of that you don't believe that there's a problem, why would you want to do this? If you don't think there's anything wrong, why would you want to regulate your economy in this fashion? You wouldn't. You only have to do it because we have a problem. That's why the deniers deny the problem. And their thinking goes from effect to cause rather than from cause to effect. They don't like the tax. Thus, there must not be a problem to require a tax.
When Lindsey Graham decided to leave Kerry Lieberman, you say the tactic was out of the Frank Luntz playbook.
Well, no, actually, Luntz was involved in messaging before Lindsey Graham left, when he was still involved with Kerry and Lieberman. And that's what I call the Trojan horse message that puts climate and the climate change problem in the belly of the beast and tries to let the promise of clean jobs and clean energy pull the contraption along. So you say we need to get on the course for clean energy for a lot of reasons. We need to compete with the Chinese. We don't want to be spending $1 billion a day on oil and sending that overseas. We want homegrown clean electricity. And by the way, there's this climate problem that we'll help solve if we do that. So Lindsey Graham was sort of he was in the camp saying, let's not call it cap and trade and let's not talk about the climate problem much, but let's try to pass a cap and trade without calling it that, that affects the climate without admitting that there's a problem. So there's a little bit of a convoluted approach there. But it's hard to be a Republican in favor of climate action in the United States in 2010, and that's a sad thing.
Eric Pooley is the deputy editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He's served as managing editor of Fortune, editor of Time Europe, and national editor, chief political correspondent, and White House correspondent for Time magazine. His book, The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth, is published by Hyperion. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me today, Leonard.